So with that, I think we can go ahead and officially get ready to launch into our first part in today's Introduction to Groundwater High Resolution Site Characterization. So at this time, I will invite my first speaker to unmute their microphone and begin sharing their presentation content. I'll confirm when we've got it up. Matt, I can see you've opened up your mic, so let me add your video spotlight here so the audience can see you. And then Matt, once you get your slides up there, I'll confirm and I will turn it over to Matt Jefferson, who works here at the same office at EPA's Technology Innovation in Field Services Division. Matt, your slides are up. They look great. So take it away.
All right. Thank you, Jean. And yes, this is welcome. This is groundwater high resolution site characterization. And the primary reason why we built this course was that we wanted to offer a number of different technologies for those of you who are doing hazardous waste groundwater groundwater site characterization. And these techniques are not necessarily new. They've been around for about 30 years or so. But what we've seen in our office is there's a number of stakeholders that do come back to us and say the only option to do site characterization for our groundwater or subsurface is through monitoring wells. And there we want to present a number of different options that are out there here. So that gets to our course objectives here. And so what we want to do after this particular course, we want to define what high resolution site characterization is. Explain the need and the benefits of this particular technique, describe the contaminant hydrology in the context of using this particular technique, and then plan for and use strategies, methods, and tools for using this particular technique using a couple of publications that we've had. One of them is the Smart Scoping Best Practices, and also using data management, visualization, and analysis. And included with this particular thing, particular course, we have also a checklist that will help you go through the process as presented through these various modules here. So the way this course is laid out, the first two modules here, fundamentally, what we're doing is providing the fundamental concepts of high resolution site characterization. There are both virtual modules here, which we will walk through introduction of what high-resolution site characterization is and talk about the hydrogeology and how it impacts the subsurface heterogeneity here. The next modules, we have a total of seven. The next modules following the virtual modules are actually done in person. And they will focus upon the strategies, methods, and tools specifically for high-resolution site characterization. And you can find those by our Trainix website. You can register for those via that particular website here. So introductions. Again, my name is Matthew Jefferson. I'm with the United States Environmental Protection Agency. I'm with EPA headquarters. My background is I have a master's and bachelor's degree in environmental engineering. I've been I've been with EPA for over 20 years, specializing in environmental characterization and remediation. I started my career with EPA as a remedial project manager in EPA Region 9, that is in San Francisco. I then moved on to EPA Region 7, which is located in Kansas City. And now I'm with the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation and headquarters here. And my job is primarily to assist both project managers and hazardous waste professionals with site characterization, building conceptual site models, optimization, soil to groundwater sampling techniques, and thinking about sort of completion strategy in the hazardous waste cleanup realm here. That is my introduction here. I'm going to pass the mic over to my colleague, Cindy.
Hello, my name is Cindy Frickle. I'm in the same office as Matt, so I don't want to bore you with too much repetition there, but I sit in the branch across the hallway from him where I work on more of technology assessment. And my background is in geology and biogeology. So that really just means I'm a biology flavored geologist. And before I came to EPA about 5 years ago, I used to work in consulting. And I was also a well drilling inspector for a little bit out in East Bay, California. Woohoo! all right, next up, I think I'm passing it to, is it Ben? Yes. Thanks, Ben.
Unmuted. Okay. All right, then. Hi, I'm Ben Benkowski. I'm a hydrogeologist here in Region 4 in the Superfund Division. I've been doing environmental work in the Southeast since 1986. I think that's 34 years, but I've only been with the agency about 14. Did a lot of consulting and federal contracting for that point. So I work on hydrogeology and vapor intrusion issues in our region. Started in the oil business, quite a while ago. But I've been doing this for quite a while, and I look forward to speaking with you guys about an hour and 15 minutes. And I guess it's Jim Rice, your turn next.
Thanks, Ben. So I'm Jim Rice. I'm with ICF, and I'm a geologist with about 35 or so years of experience in the environmental, and like Ben, prior to that was in the oil business. As a contractor to US EPA OzReady headquarters, we support a number of different programs related to improving the efficiency of site characterization and remediation, optimization type programs with Matt and his team. My focus has been primarily on innovative techniques and tools to understand and remediate Superfund brownfield sites. My experience is very broad in terms of the types of sites: Superfund, DOD, DOE, State Superfund, brownfields, and I've used a large number of different technologies. My background is in geophysics and borehole geophysics and advanced subsurface techniques, and I'm here to support the team and provide some training in the next webinar.
Okay, thank you, Jim, and thank you all for your introductions here. Now we're going to turn this back over to you. As Gene mentioned earlier, we're going to use a number of different question and answer Q&A polls here. You'll be asked to you will be asked to various questions during this delivery. We want to try to make this interactive here. You'll either use the Q&A window to answer or participate in these multiple choice polls within Zoom itself here. And the first one of these polls is coming up next here. So we want to know a little bit about you here. So the first question is asking where you're from. If you're with EPA, please let us know whether you're from the regions or headquarters. If you're with one of our other partners here, states, tribes, consultants, various other folks, industry, please let us know. Next question, what's your typical experience or project in your role? With your role here, please type in the Q&A window. Several examples could be a project manager, risk assessor, hydrogeologist, engineer. And then finally, what's been your experience with high resolution site characterization? Please enter that within the Q&A window as well.
All right, Matt. So I can confirm the audience is following along. About 85% of them have voted in that poll pop-up window. So remember, if you haven't done this before, just click the circle to the answer that matches your reply and hit the submit button. I'll give you all just a few more seconds to answer that one. And I'm starting to see a lot of responses get typed into that Q&A in regards to that question. So with about 92% of the audience having voted, let me close it down and let's take a quick look at those results. So it looks like over a third of the audience is identifying coming from the consulting sector, but about 20% are EPA regional staff. We do have a representation from EPA headquarters, about 20% also coming from state regulatory agencies, and then about 16% identify from another sector. So that's a great diverse group, wouldn't you say? And yes. I'm also looking at, it seems like hands down, we have a lot of project managers. There are a lot of them in here. We also do have a number of engineers though, or geologists and hydrogeologists. And it seems as though people have very little experience with HRSC as I'm scrolling through this. They may have heard of it, but I'm seeing a lot of answers that I have no experience at all. So there you go.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all for participating in our poll and giving us a little bit of information about you and why you're here, and welcome. All right, so moving on here, we're going to go into our first module, which introduces the concept of high-resolution site characterization. And with that, I'm going to turn the mic over here to my colleague, Cindy Frickle, who's going to give a refresher on the conceptual site model, which is the key piece in thinking about high resolution site characterization.
Thank you, Matt. Let's see. There we go. Okay. Jean, can you confirm you're seeing my screen?
I do. The slides look great. Go ahead, Cindy.
Thank you. Okay. Like Matt said, we're going to start off with a CSM refresher. I'm sure that most, if not all of you, know what a conceptual site model is, so I'm not trying to insult your intelligence. Just want to make sure that we're starting off from the same baseline. So like Jean mentioned today, we've got a whole participant manual for you online. So just to give you an idea of how much more content is in there, here's the slide, here's all the extra notes. So make sure you check those out. It's got a lot more juicy detail than we have time to give you verbally today. So starting off here, let's see, there we go. Just move that out of my way. Okay, so first off, what is a conceptual site model? This is really our expression of the collective site knowledge. So it's always written at least, and usually there's some graphical depiction as well. So maybe you don't have the fancy technology to make these cool looking 3D models, but you probably also have thought about doing at least like a plan view of your site with maybe some cross sections cut through there. So you know what's going on at your site in 3D. Now, the reason why it's important that you have a good conceptual site model is that this is really the basis for your project design and everything you're going to do that's going to cost probably a good amount of money. So you want to make sure that you have a good CSM to start with. And another important point that we can use our CSM for is we use it to create a platform that maintains our stakeholder consensus. So we use our CSM to first create our baseline. And then from there, we make sure everyone's on the same page and as with respect to what's going on at the site. And then we can move out from there. And if we aren't all in consensus on the site conceptual model in the beginning, that's going to create lots of problems further down the road. We always want to update our CSM throughout the project life cycle. Matt mentioned that we would give a checklist for you. Here's a little sneak peek at it in the slide here. We are not only looking at what we know about the site, but you also want to make sure to include what do we not know about the site? So what are our uncertainties or data gaps? That's going to be important, as you'll see. And this is going to be essential to a successful project. So if you want a good result in your cleanup, then you definitely need to pay attention to your conceptual site model. Let's see here. There we go. Okay. So your project lifecycle CSM, as we often call it, it is meant to support all of the phases of your project. So these are the phases that we've broken down in the Superfund process, and these can really be applied to all cleanup projects. So first we develop a preliminary CSM, and that's done, you know, when we just have discovered a site. And then we'll go from there, we'll develop our systematic planning, which will get us into the baseline CSM. So that is where we document what the current understanding of the site is with all of our stakeholders. We're all on the same page. Then from there, we start our characterization. So that's, I think that's kind of where a lot of us start to think about what is our CSM, because that's what we tend to build out our CSM a lot in the characterization stage. So really we should have a CSM before that, and then we're just building on it. And that is going to guide where we go in our characterization efforts. Next, once we have characterized our site well, then we continue using our CSM in the design phase. And we are using the CSM to support our decisions for our remedy or our redevelopment design. Next, we go into the remediation or mitigation stage, and our CSM is still guiding what we're doing. It's going to confirm if we've met our objectives, and it will help us understand if we need to go into optimization. And then finally, at the end, we will use our CSM to confirm and document that we have met our remediation objectives and goals. So when we talk about a CSM, these are all of the 8 components that we're referring to. So your CSM at all of those phases ought to include all of these pieces. So these will be in our checklist and we'll talk about them more. But just to do a quick overview, that includes the past uses of the site. It's going to include any previous investigations or actions that have been completed. What is the media that's affected or medium? And what sort of transport mechanisms are occurring at the site? Next, we need to look at what is our intended reuse, and that might also flow into what are the decision criteria. So maybe what are our cleanup levels depending on the reuse? We also have other decision criteria related to characterization. Then we get to the pathway receptor network, or PRN. What we're looking for there is what are our risks? Who's in danger of coming into contact with these contaminants? Another component is which technologies or approaches are applicable for this site or for this contaminant or these conditions? And then what is our completion strategy? So I think you might see at this point, a lot of these are kind of interconnected. So be thinking about that. That's going to be important. I've got a quick knowledge check for you. So true or false, it is important to address each component of the CSM on a regular basis. Jean, help me out here with the results.
All right. So ladies and gentlemen, we have another pop-up and you simply need to pick true or false and then hit submit. And remember, there's no penalty for getting it wrong. So we do strongly encourage you to take your best get and go ahead and submit. And I don't want to keep us waiting too very long. So I'll give you just another few seconds. And I think I'm going to go ahead and end this poll with 80%. And Cindy, 92% of the audience said true. How did they do?
All right. 92% of you had the correct answer. So it is important that you look at all these things on a regular basis, because like I mentioned, a lot of them are interconnected. So if you get new information in one area, it could very well propagate and make changes for other areas. So you need to make sure you're incorporating all that information as you receive it. So thank you, Jean. And thank you everyone who played along. Okay, there we go. Okay, so let's get into the nitty gritty. What is high resolution site characterization? And we won't get into the argument of whether the H should mean high or higher or highest, probably not highest. What we really mean with that high is that it's high enough so that it matches the scale of measurement with the scale of the variability of property that's being measured. This is kind of a mouthful, so let me see if I can demonstrate this. So I am going to make chili for dinner tonight. So I've got a can of beans. I am also going to probably put some chili powder in it, some salt and some spices, but I'm measuring my beans by the can and I'm measuring my salt and spices by a teaspoon. It's not really interchangeable. Bad things could happen if I put in a can full of chili powder or salt that, or, you know, even if I just tried to use this to measure it. So you really want to think about matching the correct scale, all right? So that's first lesson for today. Don't put a can's worth of salt in your chili. It'll be bad. All right, so what do we mean? What type of investigation is really high resolution site characterization? So that means our investigation is appropriate to the scale of heterogeneity that exists in the subsurface, because these will control the contaminant distribution, our fate and transport of contaminants, and it will really give us the degree of detail that we need to understand the important things about our site, like exposure pathways, what kind of processes are present that are affecting the fate of contaminants, what is the contaminant mass distribution, what phase is it in, what's the flux by phase, is it mobile or immobile, and also if we institute remedial measures, how might that affect the contamination? Okay, so how is HRSC data collection different from, you know, regular old site characterization that we're used to doing, since it sounds like a lot of us here have not had a lot of experience? One of the first things it does is gets you a whole lot higher density of measurements. And so you're going to have a lot more data to deal with. And it's going to use collaborative data sets. So you'll have maybe multiple probes that you're using to do subsurface characterization, or maybe you'll have like a field method and a lab method that you can compare with each other. So you kind of get a little more overlap. Then it employs strict field QA/QC. So you're doing your quality assurance and quality control, which you have planned out well ahead of going out into the field. So you've got all of that down. You're going to be able to maximize how much use you get out of that data because you've planned it out so well beforehand. And you'll have a good plan in place for how you will do your confirmation samples or any kind of collaborative sample analysis when you need to. So high resolution site characterization also often uses field-based action levels, meaning like maybe if you hit this contaminant level here, then that means you're going to step out further and take more samples in that area. So you would build things like that into your plan. And one of the other key components of HRSC is that you use real-time data management and communications. So this helps you stay on the same page with your stakeholders. You can make your decisions collaboratively and really just keeps everyone involved. Okay, so another example, not too far off from my chili example. Basically, if you want to see a bird across a field, you're going to use binoculars to look for them, right? But if you want to look at paramecia, or I would look for rotifers if I were looking in pond water because they're super weird and cool, you would use a microscope for that. But what are you looking for, and how many data points do you need? So you really need to have your objectives in mind. So if you just want to know if a bird is present, maybe you can just, you know, pick up your binoculars, look at one field of view, hey, there he is. But if you want to know how many are there in a certain area, you would need to look at multiple fields of view. So in our world, what we're doing is looking at different fields of view to make sure we get proper data coverage. Okay, now we've talked about kind of what high resolution site characterization is. Now we want to make sure that we have it in our minds that there's a difference between characterization and monitoring, because like we'll talk about a lot today, people often use monitoring wells as a characterization tool. It's kind of in the name, it's a monitoring well. So let's think more about what are some characterization tools that we can be using and what do we want those characterization tools to do? So our objective for site characterization is usually to identify the extent of contamination and what is the nature of that contamination and where might we have some data gaps. So there are specific tools that are useful for that, and we will talk about them more later. But just keep in mind that these tools and approaches are separate from the site monitoring ones. So typically with site monitoring, we want to, after we've done our characterization, we select an area where we know this region is characteristic of what we want to know at the site. So we can target where we want to put our monitoring wells or other monitoring technology and stick to that. So main idea here is, remember, there are different tools for site characterization and for site monitoring. Okay, I think I've got another quiz for you here. And Jean, I'm not sure how this one's set up, but
yeah, so Cindy, thanks. Yeah, no problem. So ladies and gentlemen, in this time, we'll go ahead and ask you to direct your responses to these two questions using the Q&A. So you can simply type the number one and then answer question number one in your experience, what are good characterization tools? And then type the number two, and you can type your response to, with these characterization tools in mind, what would be good monitoring tools? And then when you're done, simply hit the submit button in that Q&A and I'll start scrolling through the responses and we'll share those with our speakers here in just a moment, sort of summarizing the trends. You can answer the two questions in separate responses or you can just roll it up into one, just making sure you label them. And as I'm looking at some of these responses, just a couple attendees, Cindy, have noted that like they haven't done any characterization work yet because they're so new or this is a new area for them. But I'm starting to see for question number one, it looks like MIP or LIF, DPT investigations. A number of people are talking about hollow stem augers, boreholes and cores, packer tests, tracer tests. They mentioned for number one, geologic maps and historical data, stratigraphy information, groundwater, both up and down gradient characterization, monitoring wells. So I'm seeing a lot. Also somebody direct push tools like MIHPT and then monitoring wells as well. Mm-hmm. So those are the number one responses. And for number two, a number of people are entering in monitoring wells. Or wells in the quarterly sampling events. Let's see, a lot, that seems to be like hands down the number one, and it's not gonna pop up as a separate poll window. This is a short response. So you type your answer in to the Q&A window. So without a doubt, it seems to be number two is with everybody's just chiming in with those groundwater monitoring wells. Although someone did share the suggestion of statistical analysis.
Ooh, all right. Well, I'm going to call them up because I don't have much stats background. all right. Thank you, Jean. Well, it sounds like a couple of people still put monitoring wells in number one. We would really like to get you away from that and you'll see more why. Those are all great suggestions for characterization tools. And we'll talk more about both of these kinds of tools later. But it sounds like y'all are kind of getting it. Even for those of you who haven't started doing any site characterization yet, I'm glad that we caught you now when we did, so we can teach you the best way to do it right off the bat. and you'll be sure to have more success at your sites that way. Okay, so let's take a quick look at kind of what we used to do, how we used to conceive contaminant plumes. And I was looking at this slide this morning and it made me think of a Calvin Harris song where the line is, it was acceptable in the 80s, it was acceptable at the time. Well, I guess back then we thought that things were maybe a little more heterogeneous homogeneous in the subsurface, and that if we had a landfill with some contamination under it, things just kind of spread out in a diffuse plume laterally in the direction of groundwater flow. But now we know better because it's been a few years and we've learned some things. And we see that really what plumes are doing is they tend to have kind of a core that follows with the geology, is controlled by the hydrogeology. And it tends to just kind of go down gradient, and then it has a little bit of diffusion outward. So we'll see a little more of that in a minute. Okay, so the way that sites were often characterized back in the day is we would put in another monitoring well here, one there. We would just add more over time, so it looked like we had pretty good coverage. So, you know, there's not like a big space here where you don't have any monitoring wells. So we really know our site, right? That was the idea. Now we kind of liken that to throwing darts at a board with a blindfold on. We really have the technology and the ability to be able to understand our sites better than this. And we don't have to just like toss monitoring wells in all over the place. We can do things more effectively if we strategize and keep in mind how the geology and hydrogeology are affecting the contaminants at the site. So we'll talk about that more later. Yeah, don't do that. So another quiz question for you. What is going to influence the size and shape of a plume map? And we'll give you just a moment to answer this question here. Select from the contaminant properties, aquifer properties, your measurement points, locations, maybe where you put your wells, or all of the above.
All right, Cindy, I think they're getting the hint because they all seem to be honing in on one particular answer for this. And this is a pop-up poll question, so this should be a new window that's popped up on your screen. For those of you on a mobile device, you'll see a little alert at the bottom next to the three dots. You can click on that to open up the poll. All right, I'm going to go ahead and end this and just show you that without a doubt, 95% of our participants today picked D, all of the above.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's not what we have for the answer. We have C as our answer. So it's kind of a tricky question. So we're just talking about the plume map, not the actual plume. So you're correct that your contaminant properties and your aquifer properties would influence the size and shape of your plume, but the way that we depict it is based on our location of monitoring points. So if you have a monitoring well over here and one over here, and you know, like that whole dartboard that we showed a minute ago, the contaminant is kind of averaged across the space between those monitoring wells. So where you have a lot of monitoring wells in an area, it's possibly going to look like you have more contamination than you do in an area where you don't have wells. So if this doesn't make sense yet, we'll get into it more and it will make sense later. But I think that is a little bit of a tricky question. So forgive me for that one. Let's keep going.
You've gotten some comments in the Q&A that was trickly and they were wrestling with it and they were not sure.
Well, I didn't write it, so don't hate me. All right. Let's go into a little bit about monitoring wells. So I know we mentioned earlier, and this is really a point that we're going to try and continue to drive into you all. What monitoring wells are doing is not really describing the whole site conditions. So it's only describing the area, you know, that it's in, right? So you want to remember that the investigation technology that's used is going to influence the understanding that you develop. And that's why we'll talk more about characterization technologies later. And again, the scale of measurement needs to be appropriate for the scale of heterogeneity that's on your site. And that is something that you would look at early on, is figure out what's your scale of heterogeneity. So these are a few examples of why it's not appropriate. But the main idea is you could have your well, your monitoring well, in the wrong place. So if you're going out and putting a whole bunch of wells on your site and using that for site characterization, you might not be in the region that you think you are. So maybe you think you're up gradient, but you're not. Or maybe you're in a mixed plume. You really need to understand what's the whole layout of your site before you decide where you put your monitoring wells. And I'll get into some more in the next slide. Okay, so let's see, I want to use this image. Okay, so conventional monitoring wells are not great investigation tools, and here's why. Your whole sample is basically averaged across the length of your well screen. So maybe you have just this little tiny region where your contaminant's getting through. You have a high hydraulic conductivity zone that's, you know, a centimeter or less thick. So then what you're doing is adding water from all these other zones and you're watering down your sample essentially. So that doesn't give you a good idea of what your conditions are across that lithology. And really monitoring wells don't notice any of those small scale heterogeneities that are gonna control the contaminant transport. And that's again, because you're averaging across the length of your well. And another issue with monitoring wells that I think we don't always think about up front is those things are expensive. If you've got like, I think that example had like 15 or 17 wells, something like that on it, those all have life cycle costs. So not only are you having to install that well, you might have to recondition it later if it gets fouled up. You are certainly going to need to properly abandon or close it at some point, which is going to have costs. So we'll look at an example in a minute where we used 3 monitoring wells as opposed to, you know, the 15 or 17 that were at that example that we just showed. So save yourself some money and some time and figure out the best places to put your monitoring wells before you start sinking them in. Okay, so just to summarize, what is HRSC? It's really a matter of figuring out your sampling scale. So what's the appropriate scale to measure? And keeping in mind that your data is averaged across those scales. So you wanna make sure that you're using a scale that's meaningful with respect to the variability. And then you need to make sure that you have enough measurements at the right locations. So we were talking about looking at horizontal spacing or vertical spacing. Certainly, most of you probably have it in your head that you're going to have much less variability laterally than you would have vertically. So keeping that in mind. And that is how we get HRSC. So it's really just these two things, the sampling scale and remembering your data averaging, and then getting proper coverage. Okay, so here we're going to look at an example. And so what we have here, I think you can see my my mouse a little bit here, but so we have a building of some sort here. There's a source that kind of looks like drums maybe. In this example, we had PCE. Was the contaminant. And then groundwater flow is going from the left to the right of the page. And so we have unsaturated overburden and saturated overburden and bedrock down below. I think we didn't quite get into the bedrock on this example to keep things simple. So what we're going to do here is we're going to take high resolution borings in transects, 3 transects that are perpendicular to the groundwater flow direction. So if groundwater is going this way, we're taking a transect here, here, and here, right? And at each of those boring points, which you see is the little dots on the line here, we're using a profiling tool where we're getting, let's say we use some sort of direct push technology and we're using a membrane interface probe to check out the hydraulic conductivity. And we have a resource in the slides, in the notes here. There was a brownfields roadmap website that gives you a whole list of other technologies that you might use for site characterization like this. So other things that you could use with this platform technology. Okay, so let's go to this next slide and we'll see what we got with that data. Okay, so we've got a CPT log here and then the index of hydraulic conductivity. So from those logs, we have interpreted this lithology at the site. So these like stippled light colored zones are lower hydraulic conductivity. And then these tan solid zones are So this is a higher conductivity zone and the tan is a lower conductivity zone, such as like a silt or clay. So what you see here in the 3D view now is there is a there are like two lenses of silty, there's three, there's another one down there. So you see kind of where the sandy zones are in between. And then this stuff that's like light brown, that is going to be more of a silty clay zone where you're not getting as much flow through there. So what we're going to see next is going to be a transect, this AA prime. So we'll take a slice there and then flip it. Okay, so what we got here is you can see in the red zone here, that is our plume core. So typically about roughly 75-80% of your contaminant mass is going to be in 5-10% of your cross-sectional area. So we showed that in this example here. So you can see there's a very small window where most of your contaminant is getting through. So when you go to design your remedy later, you're going to really want to target that area because everything else is dilute. And that will be a little easier to clean up once you target this plume core. So in our example here, you can see those tan regions, those are the low permeability zones. But in this example here, we could see that there was some diffusion that happened into those zones. So we want to keep that in mind later on when we're trying to design our remedy, because we have not only this, this plume core in the more transmissive zone, we also have a little diffusion issue. So that could potentially be a back diffusion problem later down the line, depending on how old this plume is and how long that's had to seep into that zone. Okay, so the main idea of this slide is most of your contaminant is going to be in a very concentrated area. So you really want to figure out where that is on your site and just target that for your remedy. And you're really not going to be able to do that if you're just using monitoring wells. Because remember, if you had them kind of scattered all over the place on this site, so it looked like you had good distribution, you wouldn't necessarily catch where that plume core was. Now, if you look at all three of those transects together, you can really see now that there is kind of a little web duck foot coming through. So you've got your source zone coming down and then it's following where the lithology allowed. And it's just mostly in that one little layer because it was following that that high permeability zone. Okay. One more slide here. So I'm going to show you what we did with all that information. When we got into the remedy phase, this shows how we could use different technologies to address different parts of the site. So in our source zone here, we can target by excavating, getting a lot of that source out. And then we are going after the plume. In the source area, we are both excavating and then we put in a soil vapor treatment system to make sure that we get out any vapor that's already gotten into the subsurface. Then in our plume core region, what we're putting in is a targeted pump and treat system. So we have a couple of pumping wells and a reinjection well here. So that's three wells there. Further down, we've got on our plume leading edge, so ahead of the plume core. You know, we've already got that diffuse contaminant coming down. We are doing some in situ bioremediation in this zone, and then we're recirculating that water. Okay, now if you count them, there are 1, 2, 3 monitoring wells. We just have one in each area. So one in the source area, one in the plume core, and one in the leading edge of the plume. So each of those is characteristic of what is happening on that portion of the site. And we only need one in each of those areas to really do our monitoring. So you can see that by doing this high resolution site characterization, you get better info across the site. You can get a good understanding of where everything is on in the subsurface, and you can really target, you can do a much more precise remedial action, and that will really save you money because you won't be over-engineering anything. You won't be sinking monitoring wells that you don't need, adding additional costs. And this is really what we would like for everyone to be doing. Okay. So thinking about some sites that you might have, please go ahead and put in the Q&A, what's the reason why you'd want to use high resolution site characterization at your sites?
All right, so again, Cindy, as I start to see some of those responses come in, I will go ahead and narrate some of them as they're coming in that Q&A. I do see a few attendees have noted that there was an error or typo in one of the URLs on the slide. So I just wanted to let everybody know that I have a corrected link. I will be directly sending it to you all. So don't worry, we'll get that fixed. So thanks to those who chimed in and reported that.
Thank you.
So as I'm scrolling through these answers, some people note that that they have complex sites, that it's required by regulators. Mm-hmm. They may have soils with high water tables in their region. It looks like their current pump and treat systems isn't as effective as they thought it would be. They're looking for a more cost-efficient assessment and remediation for their clients. Again, more cost savings on the CSM and remediation efforts. They're doing these things to locate permeable transmissive zones. So a lot of people are chiming in that they have complex sites, and I'm starting to see a pattern here that they're really just trying to be efficient with the resources that they have.
Yes, awesome. All right, thank you, Jean. Yeah, it sounds like you all are getting it. So let's go on to the next segment. I think I'm passing back to Matt, and Matt's going to keep us rolling. So we'll learn some more about how we want to do high resolution site characterization.
Okay, thank you, Cindy, and thank you guys. Let's see. All right. Jean, are you seeing my screen share now?
I am. Go ahead.
Fantastic. All right. So as Cindy alluded to, why do we want to do high resolution site characterization? I think some of that started to come out in some of the Q&A that you guys had responded to in the last question here. But we want to reinforce some of that in a lot of ways here. So what are the benefits? You guys have already identified some of the main reasons here. The first part is the overall cost and time savings here. What we want to do is we don't understand what's going on in the subsurface. It would be nice if we had some magical tool that could tell us everything that is under there. But what this technique can do is reduce the remedial footprint and think about how we increase the remedial efficiency and reduce project timeframes. The other piece that Cindy talked about in terms of the application is that this is flexible and scalable. So we have a variety of different types of tools and technologies that are available depending on what type of site you have here. And this can be used for not only the large sites, but it can also be used for the small sites as well. So let's talk a little bit about some of the primary concerns about using high resolution site characterization. And I don't know if you guys have seen sort of like movies or different television shows where somebody's trying to make a very difficult decision, and all of a sudden an angel pops up on one of their shoulders and then the devil pops up on the other shoulder, and they're starting to talk amongst that person about trying to figure out what to do in a very difficult situation. So we're going to play this out here in a lot of ways. And so, if I'm thinking about the concerns about high resolution, the most common one that I hear, the devil inside of me would say, oh, Matt, high resolution site characterization is just too expensive. But the angel inside me would say, well, when you look at the entire project lifecycle, I mean, what we're spending on a project, high resolution site characterization is less expensive than your traditional approaches here. The devil inside of me would say, but Matt, high resolution site characterization, this is a science project, okay? We are here to clean up this project here. We're not here to do science. We're not here to do, this is not a dissertation of, all that is for, professors and universities and itself. But the angel inside of me would say, hey, we only use this to the extent that it is used, it uses the scientific method and it employs sound scientific principles. And you're going to hear that theme time and time again as we go through the various different principles and the tools that are used here. So finally, the devil inside would say, high resolution site characterization is mostly used for the most complicated sites in itself. Matt, you've used all these sites that are these mega Superfund sites that have all this stuff where you're spending millions and millions of dollars, right? But the angel inside would say, that's not necessarily true. That all sites could benefit from high resolution site characterization. And the complexity of the sites is generally not known until we have multiple mobilizations or perhaps years of understanding of what's going on with the subsurface in itself. So generally we don't know what's going on, even with the least complicated sites or sites that are fairly straightforward, like maybe a leaky underground storage tank. We don't know what's underneath that the subsurface. We don't understand what's going on with the geology or hydrogeology there. So we need to have that depth of knowledge to be able to give us confidence there. Okay, so let's think about this. How are we addressing the concerns with the facts, with data, with evidence associated with this, right? So tell me, this is your opportunity to type in the Q&A window. What are your concerns or questions using high resolution site characterization? Please do that now.
All right, so I am starting to see a number of them just come in. And again, this is not a pop-up window one. This is one where you just type your response into the Q&A. So some people are commenting that their concerns are cost. And then we've got a number of people chiming in that they don't know how to identify service providers or how to locate or contract something for HRSC. But cost seems without a doubt to be the winner. That's what seems to be concerning everybody.
Okay, great. Let's take a couple more seconds for you guys to respond here. And then...
Here's another one, regulatory acceptance. They're concerned that state regulators might not accept this. They're also concerned that their client may also not accept it. So the flip side, the responsible party might not want it. So just overall stakeholder. And still, again, they're looking for consultants that are capable of implementing this. Oh, how about this one? When to start when they're working on a site that has no or little investigation history. So where do they even begin?
Absolutely. Fantastic responses. Thank you so much. And a lot of the information that we're going to present to you today will provide some of that justification there, especially if you say, hey, this seems like a really good idea. How do I approach my stakeholder, my client? This is a great idea. We're using the latest state-of-the-art science that's out there. please do use this information that we have that we're presenting here. So let's handle the first part. We're gonna sort of group these into your responses into a couple of different categories here. Let's talk about the first part, which is thinking about the remedy effectiveness piece of here. And so high resolution does increase the remedy effectiveness by really looking at a detailed and realistic conceptual site model. As mentioned, as Cindy had mentioned a little bit earlier here, what we want to do is correlate that contaminant data with the stratigraphic and lithological data that's in that subsurface. And so we want to identify and delineate whatever your source area zones are. We want to understand what that contaminant mass flux is. What's going on with the contaminant itself? How is it moving through the subsurface? And we want to understand the two parts that in the subsurface, both a mobile and immobile porosity zones. And if this is a little bit foreign to you, we're going to explain that. We're going to explain what these terms mean here in the next module here. Also, what we want to do is we want to identify where that plume core is and evaluate how the plume is moving and possibly identify the stability of that plume. You know, we don't necessarily, in a lot of these cases, I'm thinking back at my experience with, site characterization is understanding, you know, what that looks like. How is that plume moving throughout it? How old is that particular plume? So there's various different ways of doing that. And then finally, characterizing the fate of transport of those contaminants in the subsurface. And with all that information, we get that detailed and realistic conceptual site model so that we can either, you know, when we go into that remedy decision phase or when we make a decision or make some sort of mitigation measure, we can now target a potential in situ or ex situ remedies, whatever remedies that are out there. On the flip side of things, we can also say, hey, we have enough evidence that we don't need to do something also. So we can at least show our progress and how we did this investigation to justify our decision making. Okay. Thinking about both the cost. In your responses, you talked a little bit about the cost of the remedies versus the cost of characterization. And those of us that have been in this business for a while know that the real cost comes when you start to build those remedies in itself. So remedies that are based off a flawed conceptual site model may not perform as expected, and it may take an increased amount of time to achieve those remedial action objectives or cleanup values that are required. And thereby you increase the overall cost of the entire project. So what we're saying is high resolution makes an investment upfront to better obtain a more complete and realistic conceptual site model. And the way I always think about it is that old adage of that ounce of prevention or the pound of cure. Which one would you rather have in this particular case? And so high resolution is, again, that upfront investment. So it means that we pay a little bit more now to avoid paying a lot more later in the project life cycle. So until that CSM really reflects the reality of the situation that you're dealing with, the investigation and the cleanup will be much more costly, meaning that we're going to pay more cost upfront to get the right CSM the first time instead of doing it and avoiding paying it later. Or even when you have a much more detailed one and you miss something, you may have to do it again. And so we do see that a lot within our program. So what we advocate is do it right the first time, right? Okay, so to emphasize this point, we're going to use this case study here. This is the South Jersey Clothing Company. This was a Superfund site. This was actually a clothing company that had manufactured various types of garments there. In order to clean these particular garments, they had used a number of volatile organic chemicals there, VOCs, mostly TC and PC. They had stored these particular chemicals in tanks, but oftentimes what they did, they had pretty sloppy practices as it was. They discharged their wastewater just strictly on right onto the ground. And so this was during the practices of less regulation during that time, during the 70s or so. They also had a number of tanks that leaked and got into the groundwater and created a massive plume that stretched further down from up to down on this figure here. So when the state originally found this, referred this over to EPA, EPA listed this on the national priorities list. It became a Superfund site. And after doing a series of investigations during the 80s, in 1991, they developed a record of decision. The decision was to do soil vapor extraction along with a groundwater extraction treatment system. They installed a number of extraction wells and then re-injected that water, further upgrading to create this sort of circulation effect that was within the groundwater aquifer system to sort of cleanse out all the contaminants within the aquifer. Where things started to get interesting, the construction of both of those systems started in 1999. In 2001, the soil vapor extraction system met its requirements, so they shut it down. In 2006, there was a large concern across, EPA and across many different sites about vapor intrusion. Since this was a chlorinated site, those particular vapors can get into homes, can get into various other things. And so the agency did do some investigation of homes that were right around where this facility was located here. And what did they find? They found that the facility itself had high concentrations of vapors within them, but also five of the residential houses around that area here. So it started to bring in more questions about, did the soil vapor extraction system really take care of the issue there? So let's take a look at some of the operational costs. Many of you had brought up this question about cost. Okay, they had an active pump and treat system that was still going despite the shutdown of the soil vapor extraction system. The annual cost of running that system was about $630,000 per year. It had to flow about 150 gallons per minute. The average VOC influent, that means the water that was coming in from the April to September 2004 timeframe, was 110 micrograms per liter of total VOCs, meaning that as they were removing those VOCs from the air stripping system, they were getting roughly about 5 pounds per year. Okay. These are some of the groundwater plumes that were shown during that, from monitoring wells and during that particular time. And you can see that there is sort of hot spots that were both in this location and this location in 2001. And then notice that there was a little bit more migration down further south. But what was of particular concern was, why are we getting this spot coming up here? In theory, what should be happening is everything should be flushing down towards this, pumping it up and retreating and recirculating and cleansing this particular aquifer out, right? But why are we starting to see this mark up here? And why are we starting to see vapors up and around the source area? Did we really address the issue? Is there something that we missed in the earlier piece? And so that got the project team thinking about what should we do? And so they started to think through, what if we did re-looked at the investigation using some of these high resolution site characterization techniques? And we'll go into this. This is sort of the decision logic that they went through in terms of thinking about the investigation. We're going to go into this in more detail in later modules, but This is what we call a dynamic work strategy that was developed here for this particular site, looking at using a tool called the Membrane Interface Probe, or MIP here. And you'll notice that there's several decision loops that say, okay, here's what we're going to do with this particular tool. Here's going to be who's going to be involved. And here's how we're going to use it to make a complete investigation of the target area. And the target area was that source area in itself. Okay. So they gridded a particular area within the source here. And here's some of the results from the Membrane Interface Probe, the MIP. And notice that there is some hotspots that they did get here. The redder, the red were higher concentrations, or where they got a stronger detection from that MIP probe. And when they compared that information, so they use a combination of this and several other real-time tools that we'll talk about in later modules, what they found was, so bear in mind here, taking a look at what this grid is, we're going to look at some of the data that comes in from this, this transects to the leftmost here. And bear in mind, keep this in mind here. Look at boring number SJCC29 here. Keep that in the back of your mind. Remember, this was one of the red dots that appeared in this particular investigation. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that more here. And they also did a number of different cores there and logged what those particular cores. And notice we've got a highlight here in a very small subsection of that particular core, right at the 20 and a half to 21. This is a very small area, which was labeled really, it was mostly a stiff clay in itself. And what they noticed was there was a pretty strong smell of solvents in this particular area. And when they took a sample of that, they did some analysis on the soils in itself, they noticed an incredibly high concentration of TCE, close to, 2.4 million micrograms per kilogram in itself. And as you look down that core, here's this core of 29, as you look at the logs for the Membrane Interface Probe. This log is a vertical log. As the probe is being advanced down that particular borehole, you can see where it's reacting to, where you have responses to chlorinations and such. And so notice that there's that spike again here, right at that 20 foot mark in itself. So when they looked at that data and in comparison of some of the historic photos that were in this particular area, one of the things that kind of popped out. So here's again, that distribution map of those concentrations from the MIP here. And you'll notice that there's this indicator here on this old photo here that says possible HT, which the team thought, oh my gosh, that's a possible horizontal tank. That may be where the source, where we have the reason why we have such high concentrations in that particular area. And so you could start to piece this together based on all this information that you're getting on this. And so what they did was, in 2010, they amended that record of decision. They said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to excavate that area, and we're going to do some electrical resistive heating in that particular area because it's such high concentration in itself. And so you can see after they did that in 2013 or so, they finished that and they removed, and they did some follow-up sampling, and it appears that they removed almost 1,200 pounds of VOC using that particular operation, meaning they've dropped the concentrations down about 95% in itself. So if you take a look at that, and you take a look at the cost of doing this particular action here, again, looking at the cost of the pump and treat system, it was about 5 pounds per year of VOCs at a cost of six, $630,000. And if you average that out per pound, you're looking at $126,000 per pound per year. But applying the high resolution site characterization techniques really honed in to say, okay, we've got the source area that we need to identify, we need to address, and we're going to address it using electrical resistant heating. And so the cost of removing that amount of mass over the 3 months of the operation of the system at this particular cost gives you about $2,000 per pound. That is an overall cost savings of $100,000 using this particular high resolution site characterization technique. Okay, so what we've seen so far over the lifetime of the program, of the Superfund program, we track a number of different remedies as they go over a period of time. And what we noticed at the beginning when we started tracking this back in 1982, the red line is indicating what our pump and treat remedies were. And notice that there has been a downward trend over a period of time as this data point ends in 2017. And we've also noticed an increasing trends in in-situ treatment. And much of that is thanks to these particular tools and techniques and procedures of thinking through of both your high resolution site characterization techniques and being able to better understand the plume characteristics and the nature and extent of the contamination within the subsurface. One other resource I want to bring attention to was something that we published back in 2014 called the Groundwater Remedy Completion Strategy. And the question that often came back to us was, well, you know, how do you know when you're done, right? And so that's why we put this particular guide together, which gave recommendations to site-specific set of actions that would help you sort of achieve cleanup or the remedial action objectives using this understanding of the conceptual site model, really truly understanding what's going on within the subsurface. And then also understanding the performance metrics there, tailoring specific metrics to say, hey, you know, how do we know we're getting to those cleanup goals there? And then gearing the data to really evaluate those site-specific remedies in itself. And a lot of this really focused on sort of focusing those resources towards making, adjustments and making, monitoring and such towards more efficient completion of those restoration remedies. And it sort of breaks it out between a remedy phase and an attainment phase for being able to call this complete. So in a lot of ways, also included with this particular, this guidance is a groundwater statistic tools that helps reinforce some of this. So I strongly encourage you to read through this particular completion strategy. It's very helpful. Other sources of high resolution site characterization materials that I would recommend, or that we would recommend here. We talked a little bit about the best practices through site characterization. That is also a CERCLA education course that's through the same portal that you found this particular course. We have a number of different CLUIN webinars associated with high resolution site characterization. Incremental sampling, that there's several different courses that are hosted by our group here along with AITRC, 3D visualization, and also a number of different classes related to characterization within fractured rock, which we'll talk a little bit about here in later modules. And we would also encourage you to visit, the CLUIN, our CLUIN website here, TrainX website. ITRC has some fantastic information as well, as well as also the CERTIP ETCP, this particular organization here. These are all fantastic websites to get more information on high resolution site characterization. So finally, how is this high resolution site characterization implemented? We're going to talk about three different methods here. And we're going to use what we're going to refer to them as the triad approach here. That is three different sides of the sort of this triangle here. These methods are called systematic project planning, real-time measurement technologies, and dynamic work strategies. And you've already seen the decision logic diagram. That was one of those. But we'll cover each one of these. So as a part of this, let's go ahead and test your knowledge here. We're pulling up a poll here. And so please let us know the goal of the triad approach of systematic project planning, SPP, real-time technologies, and dynamic work strategies is to, and please vote now.
All right. So Matt, I'm seeing these responses go in. And ladies and gentlemen, we've done a few of these. So I expect to see that number of those of you participating to shoot up here. I'm seeing the audience battling between two responses. I'll give you just a few more seconds to get those answers in. And we will be pausing later for Q&A. So for those of you who've been typing in questions, I see them. We'll be reading them out loud here to our instructors during our Q&A break in just a bit. And Matt, I think I'll go ahead. We've got about 75% of the audience voting. So let me end it and we'll look at those results. So it looks like about 85% of the audience picked option C, manage uncertainty. But a number of them also thought that it was A, to bring the cost down.
Okay. Well, the correct answer here is two. Manage uncertainty. Those of you who voted for C, that's correct. We want to understand what's going on. We use these tools to manage the uncertainty of our sites, especially when we're thinking about site characterization, because there is so much uncertainty during that particular phase in itself, during the investigation phase. All right. So let's talk a little bit about, thank you so much for voting for that, for voting during our poll here. Let's talk a little bit about each one of those legs of the triad itself here. So let's talk about one of those methods, the systematic project planning. And what is it? For those of you who are somewhat unfamiliar with the terminology, a lot of folks think of it as your scoping meeting. But what we want to do, the ultimate goal of the systematic project planning, is we want to build a process for building consensus vision for conducting environmental investigation remediation. So we want to really understand what our objectives are and how we're going to approach those objectives in a way that we can describe all the tools and approaches that we have. And this is a really important part of this, of the triad itself. We need to be able to have that discussion. Okay, so what are we going to talk about? We're going to shift to the next leg of the triad here with thinking about the real-time tool, real-time measurement technologies. We can sort of break up these technologies into two different categories here. One is those direct sensing tools that provide us instantaneous information that's out there. And then there's another set of tools that give us field-generated sample collection and different types of analysis technologies that require various of lengths of time to be able to get that end data there. And we're going to talk a little bit more about those specific tools here in the next modules coming up here. And then the final one, you guys have seen this once before here. These are the dynamic work strategies. So all the things that we did before, remember those systematic project planning meetings, those real-time tools that are out there, we want to incorporate those into our work plans and develop decision logics. And that's what those dynamic work strategies, that's the advantage of using these dynamic work strategies, is that when we go out and do one of these investigations, we take the time to mobilize and get everybody involved. We want to do it in an efficient manner. We want to do it preferably in one mobilization, or get the most out as we can possibly in that particular mobilization and delineate the contamination. And that's what this is ultimately doing. That's the example that we've shown. We want to get the most information so that we can make a decision there. Okay, so we have given you just sort of a high-level overview or introduction to the high-resolution site characterization. We covered the what, we've covered the why, and we've talked a little bit about how we do that. So where we are going from here into the future modules here, hopefully we have whetted your appetite here. Where we're going with this is what we want to do is ultimately build and understand what that information means, because we're going to be gathering a lot of information, and how do we want to display that? And so one of the techniques that we commonly use is a 3D visualization of that information. These are various images of visualizations, different plumes that you can when you overlay the contaminants and the geology there, and really get an understanding of what the dynamics are going on with those, with the plume, how they match up with your geology, so that you can better make decisions there. Okay, I'm going to pause for a moment for questions here about any of the information that you've heard from this module.
All right. So, Matt, there were a number of questions that came in, and this was actually earlier in the talk. You referenced a checklist, and some of the participants were wondering where or when we will be revealing the checklist that I think you talked about, and Cindy even gave them a little preview.
Yes, yes. Let's see. I think that comes with some of the course materials. And Jim, if you don't mind taking yourself off mute and clarifying that with me.
Sure. So the checklist is going to be available to the participants. I did just send it to one of our moderators, and just wanted to let everybody know that it's a checklist that we'll be discussing much later on in the modules. And it's just, it's more of a flow chart about how to use HRSC and the types of information you might want to use to collect, you might want to use to analyze the subsurface. And I want to let everybody know that EPA is in the process of revising and updating the spreadsheet and automating it. It's just a real series of checklists. But Matt, if you're okay releasing the 2015 version, you know, we can release that to the folks, to the participants, and then provide an updated list when it's available.
Yes. Let's go ahead and do that. And thank you guys for the question.
Okay. So a lot of people have commented on the visualizations that we've shown in the slides, and people are is there a preferred software? Did EPA develop a software? Where can they get whatever you use to make those pictures?
Well, I'll start off with a response, and I'll let other folks chime in here. We're going to talk a little bit about more specifics on that 3D visualization software, what we use. We actually use a software package from EarthTech called EVS MVS. They're fantastic tools. They sort of work great, like looking at a Google Earth image, but it really helps site teams, project teams really get their arms around developing a strategy about how they may approach or mitigate contaminants there. So, but let me see if other folks have comments in regards to that.
Yeah, Matt, let me make a couple of comments on that. Absolutely. 3D visualization is a very powerful tool, and we do talk about that in Module 6. We provide some examples and some details of what goes into a visualization and the different types of data sets that you can use. So in terms of the software, there's probably a half dozen different types of software, brands of software out there that are commonly being used. As Matt mentioned, EVS is probably from C-Tech Studios is probably one of the more common ones. You may have heard of LeapFrog, and there are a few others. And then on the simpler side, those are very sophisticated programs run by experts. It's a pretty steep learning curve, and they're pretty costly programs. But on the simpler side, and again, we'll talk about this in Module 6, something as simple as Voxler, which is part of the Grapher, Surfer, Golden Graphics package, can actually give you a pretty good understanding, as Matt talked about, scalability. On the simpler side, these are tools that, while not as sophisticated as LeapFrog or EVS, can at least give you that three-dimensional view with this high-resolution, dense data set.
All right, great. I'm going to go back to a question that came in for you, Matt. A number of people have some questions about exactly how you're getting some of the field data that's being used. They're either not familiar with the technologies. You've talked about probes, and they're just curious if this is a single collection event, if there's multiple field collection events. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I would assume that that's related to the case study that we had presented. Yeah, they used a number of different probes. So there was a direct push in that particular case study, along with a membrane interface probe. And they also took soil cores during that particular time. And so those were all during one particular mobilization, but sort of at different time periods there. And oftentimes we'll talk a little bit more about this in the later modules here about, we have one module specifically sort of targeted on this about how you might want to use those particular tools and how they might, you would layer them to complete your site investigation there. So,
okay. And I don't know if this is a question for you or Cindy, or if this is something that'll be highlighted in one of those future examples, but I've had a few people ask about how we're determining hydraulic gradients or generating transcripts without putting in monitoring wells.
Cindy, you want to hand?
Yeah, I can jump in there. I know in my experience, I've been lucky enough to work in places where there are many of neighboring contaminated sites. So you can often get your groundwater flow data from some of those wells that already exist because, you know, those have been sitting around for years and there's good data. In the case where you don't have any of that information, you might need to put some in, but first you want to check and see if there's any other data out there that could help you out. So maybe look at your geologic maps, see if there's any sort of gradient going on at site, see what your bedrock surfaces look like. There's some data that you can look at before you dive in. Let's just get away from the idea that the first thing we need to do is put in a monitoring well. That's the main thing.
Okay. And so Cindy, just a quick clarification. Some of the attendees were wondering if HRSC, when you're working in the saturated zone, are you collecting data that's measuring contaminant concentrations in groundwater or what's sorbed onto the soil matrix or both?
Yeah, that's a good question. It depends on what technology you're using. So maybe your first screening tool, your first set of transects that you do, you won't get all of that information. But if you know that you have, you're likely to have the type of geology where you could have sorbed contaminants, that you want to take that into account when you're planning how you're going to characterize your site.
Okay. All right. And then a couple of people have chimed in. Matt, I don't know if you want to answer this one. Is HRSC something that's required by EPA or is it something that's implemented by EPA?
Required, no. But we do implement this and we highly encourage, our project managers to do so when the conditions are favorable for doing that. And so I think this really does, we've talked plenty about what the benefits are, but we see a lot of, a vast majority of characterizations of unconsolidated environments related to this, although there are a couple of cases, like I mentioned at the very beginning, where we do see folks just wanting to throw in a bunch of monitoring wells. And we kind of say, okay, wait a minute. Well, let's take a step back and think through the planning of this. Why do we want to do this? What are our objectives here? So that's sort of the powers of thinking through the implementation piece of planning and the systematic planning process there. So,
okay. All right. And then one last question, discussion about the software. People have asked if we can recommend, or of the ones we were highlighting, the least expensive ones that might be available to them, or ballpark how expensive some of the software is. We've had a lot of people chime in that they're lucky to get 2D models, yeah, let alone some of these three-dimensional ones that we're talking about. So they're looking for something feasible that they might be able to achieve within their budget. So any inexpensive recommendations?
Maybe I'll defer over to Jim and Cindy. They got a little bit more experience than I do in that area. So,
sure. And this is a real challenge, especially on smaller sites, to get those truly sophisticated models. The software is expensive. And then there's an annual fee for updates and, you know, for maintenance and user fees and all of that, much like some of the GIS products out there. So if you already have some of the GIS products, there are sometimes 3D modules that can be used, certainly not geologically and geochemically oriented and sophisticated. Those are quite pricey. But as I mentioned earlier, Voxler, which is part of the Golden Graphics package, and there are others out there also. Rockware, I believe, also has a similar product. The Voxler product is, I know, less than $1,000, and there's, you know, no annual license fee. Once you buy the program, it's yours forever. It's the same as Surfer or Grapher. I'm not familiar with the Rockware, but again, that's an integrated tool. It's more expensive than the Voxler. And that's, I would say that, you know, the C-Tech EVS and the Leapfrog are many thousands of dollars for the software itself. And in order to run those programs and put your data in is a significant amount of time. So you have to consider the time to run the model also.
Okay. And then just for the attendees, I'll let the instructors know, a lot of people are starting to write in with specific applications in a certain type or in certain scenarios. So fractured bedrock, or how would you do this if you had vapor intrusion issues, or we have flow fluctuations due to, you know, regional influences. So I'm going to continue to collect those. We might not be able to get into those site-specific application questions, but we'll talk about how you can reach out to the instructors after the live event if you have some follow-on questions as well before we close out. So keep those questions and comments chiming in. Matt, are we ready to carry on?
I believe so. Thank you so much for the great questions here. And I'm going to turn the mic over to our next presenter here, Ben Bentowski, who's going to give a little bit more information about some of the questions that you guys have brought up about hydrogeology and the role it plays in high-resolution site characterization. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Matt. I'll have one little follow-on for something that Jim mentioned. You need to have a lot of data to do a good three-dimensional model. So keep that into consideration, because that's important. So I'm going to talk this afternoon about hydrogeology and subsurface heterogeneity. It is, it's a fact of life. Things are different in the subsurface. You don't really know how different they are until you start looking at it and understanding, understanding the various things that, the various parameters that you can collect data on to then understand the degree of heterogeneity. And it makes a big difference in all of our understanding of the, well, it feeds into the site conceptual model. It feeds into the fate and transport of the contaminant. It makes a big difference on what kind of remedial action you're going to use to clean up the groundwater. But all starts with some fairly basic ideas. And these are the seven basic concepts that I'll be going over here in the next hour or so. Maybe not quite. I think it's 3:30, right? Anyway. So first with the basics for hydrogeology, porosity, permeability, hydraulic conductivity, gradient, and velocity. So if you look at this photograph here, probably taken in some sort of sand and gravel mine, you can see a whole variety of sand features, mostly horizontal layers. Differences in the grain size, you see there's some gravel up here mixed in. There's some here that's eroded differently than the stuff above it. It'll have a different composition. But you can see right off the bat, you know, you could call this sand, but the amount of variability over a very short distance makes will make a big difference in understanding the kind of work that we do here at EPA, tracking the plume. So porosity, most basic property of a rock or of a sample, ratio of the void space to the total volume of the medium. So it's a mathematical number. It's, you can see here as it changes from non-porous on the left to connected open spaces between the sand grains in this case. And it's basically just a ratio. And you know, usually that comes up with numbers that are closer to 30% or so. That's a sort of a middle of the range value. And the rocks can be so much more different because they can be fractured or not fractured. But and the one thing that's important to know here is the clay is actually has the most porosity because it's not actually I'll get into that in a minute. There's another slide coming up here. But like it says here, that the grain size does not affect the porosity. You know, these two examples here, these grains are about three times or four times the size of these grains over here, but the ratio of the solid space to the void space is about the same. Where you get a difference here is when your grain size is not uniform. You get smaller grain size particles that fill in the gaps between the bigger ones. So here you've got little sand grains that fill in the available void space. So you end up with a lower overall porosity. So permeability. The ability for the media to transmit fluids. That's a very broad statement because it can be, you know, you think in terms of the groundwater, that's certainly a fluid. But up above the water table, then it could actually be the soil gas if you're doing some vapor intrusion work and trying to understand the flow of the air as a fluid through the porosity. Or if you have an L-napple or a D-napple, that is like a petroleum product that could float on top of the water table, or a D-napple that would be down in the rock itself or in the sediments itself. And that takes up the space as well, but that's a fluid as well. It can get pretty complicated, but right now we're just going to talk about the permeability. It's the the ability of the water or the fluid to go through the medium. And here, certainly in the grain size, does affect the permeability. So there is a calculation from Mr. Darcy regarding the formula for the calculation of permeability. Is proportional to the hydraulic gradient, which is seen over here on this figure on the right here, the difference in elevation between two hypothetical piezometers in the aquifer, and the cross-sectional area, which is this shown by this square here on the end of this unit of the aquifer. So this change in height over the change in length, that's the gradient. And Q is the flow, and A is the cross-sectional area. So from working with that, we have our first quiz question here. And I'm sorry, but I've...
Don't worry, it's okay. They're popping up on the screen here, Ben, right now.
Yes, but I don't think I've explained something to them that would allow them to get the correct answer.
All right, well.
So, maybe we can work it out.
I can end it, Ben, and relaunch it. So feel free to give them that background information and I will run this again.
Well, it's just going to make the answer quite obvious. Let me go back up here to the permeability here in porosity. One of the things we talked about, sands and gravels, and those are the things you would think of normally. It's particles compacted together in a unit in a cross section or in an outcrop. But clay is actually made up of it can be both a particle size and a type of mineral. So it's usually the smallest of particle sizes. And they're oftentimes kind of flat surfaces. And they also often have water in the mineral itself. So given the irregular nature of the size of the particle, of the shape of the particles, they often stack together in irregular ways. So it leaves a much higher void space than if you had a very uniform sand. You have a lot of variation in the size of the particle, and then they're oriented not uniformly. So that makes for a higher porosity, but poor connectivity, so lower permeability. So clicking back down here to the quiz.
All right, we've launched that quiz again. And you're asking which is a type of high porosity media. And so if you voted earlier, I have reset the poll so you can re-answer based off of that additional information from our instructor. And I'll just give you a few more seconds here to submit your response. Remember, there's no penalty for a wrong answer. All right, Ben, it looks like we've got almost 2/3 of the audience. And stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We want to keep you active and engaged all the way through the end of our class today. So I'm going to go ahead and end the poll and take a look at those results. So Ben, it looks like about 1/3 of the audience picked sand, about 1/3 of the audience picked clay, and then about 1/4 of them picked all of the above.
Well, I could see how all those answers could be true if you thought about it, but when you get right down to it, literally you get down to the granular level. the clay has more porosity because the particles were sort of stacked in funny directions. And it has more water in the minerals that are in the clay itself. So that's how come the clay ends up with more porosity.
No problem.
Okay, so this question, which I do think I covered, which part of the figure has the highest permeability?
Okay, and those answers are coming in as we speak. And this is a surprising result. They are without a doubt. Oh, here we go. A little bit of a distribution, little variation in my answers. I'm going to wait till I've got about 2/3 of the responses coming in here, and then we'll close it. But there is a clear dominant answer from the audience. And I'm going to go ahead and close this poll down now, and we'll take a look at those results. So it looks like almost 95% of the audience picked C, the right-hand side.
Way to go, because that is correct. The most connected pore spaces results in the highest permeability. So yes, it is the one on the right. So we're going to go on to hydraulic conductivity. I can get the slides to stay still. Hydraulic conductivity is the ease with which a medium transmits water. And it's important that it's different from the permeability, because it's the property of the medium and the fluid. If you look over here at the equation for calculating the hydraulic conductivity, the density of the fluid comes into play, as well as the viscosity of the fluid. The permeability is what we just talked about, the amount of connected space, connected porosity within the rock or the sample. But then you add these other terms in about the fluid characteristics, and that all goes together. You'll note here that this is actually, the result is centimeters per second. That's actually a velocity term, and it has to do with the speed at which the water moves through the aquifer. But there are some variations, like you can have multiple fluids in the same space, in the same volume rather, and it makes for a kind of a complicated estimate. But you can actually approximate the hydraulic conductivity from a grain size analysis. There's a paper somewhere that you can look at that and look at a chart and figure that out. So when you're looking at a field log and it says fine grained sand, then you look on the chart and go, oh, that probably has a hydraulic conductivity of this. So that's not everything has to be done in a laboratory setting or with performance in a field analysis with a slug test or an aquifer test. So this is a chart that shows the range of hydraulic conductivity versus the type of sands, type of materials rather. The igneous rocks are at the top, and you can see. So let's look at these units, because these units are important. Units always are. So that's feet per day. And the lowest velocity is 10^-7 feet per day. I can't even give you a correlation to that. But you look over here in the clean sand, and then there's 10 feet per day or 100 feet per day. That's moving right along, and these gravels here are 1,000 feet a day. So if you had your contamination in a gravel, it would certainly be flowing at a considerable rate. But if you get down into a clay or a shale, this is 1/1000th of a foot per day. 1/10000th of a foot per day. That's just, it's locked up pretty tight. It's not going anywhere in any hurry. And that makes a difference later about diffusion and back diffusion, which is something we'll cover in some later slides. So this is a characteristic within an aquifer. A lot of rules, a lot of papers, research papers, assume that an aquifer, if you're running a model, a very simple model, and make the assumption that it is homogeneous and isotropic. So what do those really mean? So if you look over here at these boxes, so you're, in this case, the variable that we're dealing with is the hydraulic conductivity. In this case, the hydraulic conductivity over here is the same magnitude in a different location. So it's homogeneous because it's the same in two different parts of the aquifer. And it's isotropic because the values are the same vertically and horizontally. So to go at the other end of that scale, where it's heterogeneous and anisotropic, the values are different between both places. So the vertical hydraulic conductivity is greater here than it is there, and the horizontal hydraulic conductivity is greater over here than it is over there. So this is the exact opposite case. You know, even if you think in terms of a beach like in the panhandle of Florida, it looks the same, but I've done work in Pensacola and it's just, it's not really isotropic or homogeneous. There are variations, even if it sort of looks all uniform. So this is one of those sought after three-dimensional visualizations. In this case, this was some work done by a guy named Ed Sudicki at the University of Waterloo. Folks may not know this, but the Canadians have allowed a portion of Canadian Forces Base Borden in Ontario to be used for research over the years. They don't have to, maybe they have to clean it up when they're done, but they're given wide latitude to investigate and perform research and in this area. So Mr. Sudicki actually took hydraulic conductivity measurements every 5 inches. And these are distances here. Well, excuse me, every 5 centimeters, this is Canada. So these are probably meters along here and then this way as well. So every 5 centimeters, they took a hydraulic conductivity reading. And you got an average of almost 10^-2 centimeters per second. But if you actually look at the colors displayed, you can see that it goes, it's 25 times different from here up to there, even though the average, just a little short of there. The average is this lighter green here, or this greenish blue. But you can see, even over such a very short distance, there is quite a lot of variation, even these 5 centimeter segments here. You're going to get a lot of variability. And that makes a big difference when you're talking about the contaminant flow through an area. So this is an example of five different hydraulic connectivity locations where things were investigated, and different environments, beach sand, glacial gravel. And you'll see that there really is quite a bit of difference between the different environments and the variation in the hydraulic conductivity. In general, the horizontal hydraulic conductivity correlation is much greater. You know, they're 1- and 2-digit numbers in lengths of meters, but the variation vertically is where it's the same over a vertical distance is much thinner. Now, this is only 5 centimeters here at this place in Switzerland. But you wouldn't expect the hydraulic conductivity to be the same only 2 inches above or below your location of your sample. In the fluvial gravel in Mississippi, it's got the biggest uniformity vertically, but it's still, 10 times less than it is horizontally. And that's a rule of thumb, not strictly numerically a rule of thumb, but the vertical conductivities are always going to be lower than the horizontal conductivity. That's just a fact of hydrogeology. So we're going to have a little quiz here, Jean.
All right, I'm going to pop this next poll up here on the screen, and let's go ahead and collect our answers. And again, in this case, Ben, we're posing that question, which has a greater correlation distance and therefore less heterogeneity in the subsurface? Is it A, vertical, B, horizontal, or C, both are the same? And as I'm looking at these answers, about a quarter of the audience has voted, but let's hurry up and get our responses in so that our instructors can confirm that you are here and have been paying attention and that they have been transferring some knowledge your way. And with that, I'm almost at about 2/3 of you having submitted your answers. So let me go ahead and pause on the collection and let's look at those results. So Ben, it looks like about 2/3 picked B, the horizontal direction.
Okay. Well, B is the correct answer, and all we have to do is just go back to this previous slide right here, and you can see that the horizontal correlations are much greater than the same location, but vertical correlations. So, the answer is B, less heterogeneity in the horizontal direction. So we're going to go on. We've got a couple of examples here with some using some cross sections. This is how a geologist likes to see his information usually. This is that two-dimensional view. You drill a boring, collect samples, you log the results that you get out of the split spoons or the rotosonic bags or whatever you're doing, and then you plot these thicknesses on a cross section. So you can see here we've got a variety of glacial till, which is a low permeability, mucky kind of stuff. Then you've got some the lower sand, the upper sand, and a variety of finer grain units here in the marine clay and silt. Probably a little bit of fill at the top. These are some estimated hydraulic conductivities collected from these various locations. And in this case, the data is, this is in Pease Air Force Base up in Maine. So this is in, well, it's a little confusing, isn't it? Because this is in feet, but the hydraulic conductivity is listed in centimeters per second. That's more of a, that's the more common way to talk about it. But you can see that there is quite a bit of variability just in this broader section. But in this case, this looking much closer to this rectangle here, and you'll see that there's much closer spacing for the data. And you see there's a lot more variability in the hydraulic conductivity, you know, all the way from 10 to the minus 2 in this yellow part here. And this is over just a total of 7 feet. You go 1, 2, 3 orders of magnitude over a space of maybe 3 feet or a little less. Quite a lot of variability when you get right down close to it. And that really points into the whole idea of the title of the course, high resolution. Get, collect more data so you have a better understanding of the variability. Like Cindy said about, you know, looking at the birds with the binoculars, but when you're right up close to the sand grains, you need, you know, a hand lens to actually verify the size of the particles and understand the scale of the measurements that you're collecting. It makes a big difference, as I hope you'll completely understand by the end of the second day later in the week. Well, I think this is yet another quick quiz here.
That's correct. So, ladies and gentlemen, let me pop up this very next one on the screen, and I will launch it. And so in this case, you have options to select which color in this figure corresponds to the highest hydraulic conductivity, or K. So you can pick A, the dark blue, B, the light blue, C, the green, or D, the yellow. And I've got almost half of you having answered this question. So I think here, Ben, give them just a few more seconds to respond. Anybody's having any difficulties viewing the content due to coloring issues, just let me know. You can always chat things in using that Q&A space. All right, Ben, I'm going to go ahead and end it, and we'll take a look at those results. And it looks like about 85% picked option D, the yellow color.
Yay. Because that is the correct answer. It doesn't really tell you the morphologies here that you're dealing with, but yes, just from the reading the scale here at the bottom, yellow is D is the highest hydraulic conductivity. So this is slide number 23 in my unit, and I'm only going to 28, so we're getting close to being done. So now we're going to talk about hydraulic gradient. Hydraulic gradient is a vector quality, has a direction and a magnitude. Now, calculated from water level data. So in this example over here, there are three piezometers. Oh. And you've got different water levels in all three piezometers. So there's a gradient. So think of it in terms of pressure. There's less pressure here because it didn't push the water up as far. But there's more pressure here as it pushed it up farther. And this is how that's displayed just within the sand unit itself if you didn't have the piezometers on there. The same as, and that's actually in a confined situation. This is in an unconfined situation. But then you plot those to give you an idea of the groundwater flow direction. I think that's here on this next slide here. Yes. you'll see that basically the plot, this is like a topographic surface, but with the pressures, the head as we call it, that correlates to the elevation of the water surface at that location. So from the upper sand, you've got a pretty tight gradient, and the flow is northeast to northwest from a high here in the center. Now, the clay marine silt, this at this intersection here, that's 5080 and that's 5100. So here, a little higher up, the pressure is a little less, but the groundwater flow directions are about the same. The flow directions and the speed as well. But it, when you get to this marine clay, you'll see that the gradient flattens out the further away you get from this one spot here on the south side of this. So this, within this unit, the gradient and therefore the velocity also changes. You get to a much shallower unit here, this lower sand, and it's a very shallow gradient relative to this upper sand. The groundwater flow direction is, it was both straight east here and then straight north here. So you don't get in much of this northeast component here. One thing of diamicton, unsorted or poorly sorted plastic sediments with a wide range of particle sizes. So in this case, there's actually a low here, and the groundwater flow is coming towards this, whatever it is that's draining out the water from here. So you've got a difference in the gradients with the difference in the elevations and the difference in the sediment types as well. So groundwater velocity, it's proportional, it's not proportional, it's calculated. We've covered hydraulic conductivity. I just showed you maps with the hydraulic gradient. And then that's divided by the porosity, which is one of the topics we covered earlier. Well, just from looking at the math, with the higher gradient, the higher value of I and the higher value of the porosity, you're going to get faster groundwater flow rates. That's independent of the hydraulic conductivity. So, all right, so now our last quiz. So Gina, if you'll pop that up, please.
All right, so we are popping up this very last one, launching it now, asking, what is the difference between permeability and hydraulic conductivity? So you have option A, B, C, or D. And I know some of you may have some limited capabilities of participating in the polls, given some device restrictions. You can always type in your answer in the Q&A, and we will be sure to take a look at that. And remember, we're not grading. You don't have to get 100% in the polls here to complete the class, but we do want to be sure that you're engaged and our instructors are able to interact with you in more ways in the session. So Ben, as I'm looking at this, it looks as though about half, well, now we're up to about 2/3 of the audience has participated and they have cast their votes. Remember, you simply click the circle next to the answer and then hit that submit button. And then I'm gonna go ahead and close it out here and we'll talk about the answer. And so let's take a look. So again, about 80% picked option A, that permeability is a property of the medium, while hydraulic conductivity is a property of the fluid and the medium.
That is the correct answer.
Excellent.
And again, it's, you know, we're just running through this in, you know, in half an hour. I do think that I heard in the beginning that there are many newer folks here at the agency, and this is something that you can, you'll spend more time with, and hopefully you're learning from these examples. But yes, the permeability is the property of the medium, but the hydraulic conductivity is the medium and the fluid. So with that, I think I've got the end of my section. I did not look at the Q&A.
That's okay.
During my presentation time period. So are there any questions over this section here?
Yeah, so we did have a question earlier in your talk. One of the attendees wanted to know, how was K measured in those cross sections of the high resolution?
Okay, the hydraulic conductivity, there are three or four ways to do it. The most common way is what's called a slug test. And you have a piece of slotted pipe in the ground, the slots are in the unit that you want to measure the hydraulic conductivity for. You put a water level transducer that records the water levels, and then you put a solid mass, what's called the slug, quickly into the well, and the water level will rise up. And if you think about it, once the water level rises up, it's going to drain back down to a static level. And recording that data, either with the transducer, which is the best way to do it because it's continuous and it's better quality, you can do it by hand with a water level measurement. But that can give you a graph that you can then plug into some software and calculate the hydraulic conductivity. You can do it with an aquifer test. And we don't really have time to get into all that, but you run a pump and you draw down and then you turn it off and it comes back up. You're basically changing the water level in the well and then recording how it interacts with other parts of the aquifer. We mentioned that you could do it with the approximate from a grain size analysis. And also you can, if you have core solid material, you can actually send those off to a lab and they run a triaxial permeameter. Anyway, I did that for a while in one of my first jobs out of college. And but that's a lab based with, using rock, not so much the unconsolidated material that most of our work is in.
Okay. A lot of the questions that are currently in the queue are, I think, reflected to the entire presentation. So I think we've got all of our other speakers here on the line. So Matt, Cindy, Jim, Ben, I'm just going to start reading out some of these other questions and then I'll defer to each of you to chime in and jump in if you think you can take one of these. So one of the ones I want to go back to earlier was a question about HRSC and sort of clarifying like the whole point of it. One of the attendees asked early on, isn't one of the key components of HRSC decreasing the time and therefore cost of an investigation while improving information for a successful remediation? So I don't know if anybody wants to comment if that is one of the key components, if it's all about driving that cost and time down.
I'll stick up a little bit. I think it's where you draw the line on the time. If you go out and put a bunch of monitoring wells in and you get one understanding, and honestly, we see this a lot in Superfund sites that were first done in the 80s, that were done a certain way. And now you've been monitoring the site for, 20 years and you're not, you're not getting the cleanup that you need, and you have to go back out, as opposed to the more intensive field work that we're trying to encourage now to get a higher density of data now to make a better remedial decision in the short term So I think that's my perception of the difference in the time.
Okay.
Spend a little more time now. What's that? Pay me now or pay me later? just get better data now and make a better decision now, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would agree with the commenter statement there, and along with Ben. I think it really, when you look at the project life cycle, or it's that pound of cure or ounce of prevention in a lot of ways. And bear in mind, when you look at these types of projects, the big costs really come from the mitigation piece. So the better often, the more that you can refine and have a better understanding and better target and a better strategy towards those mitigation techniques, the better off you are, as opposed to finding it out 20 or 30 years later, like what we saw in the case example, and having done the wrong remedy or not completely addressed the contamination or not being able to meet your cleanup objectives there.
Okay. We did have some questions that came in about a PEACE example earlier that was presented. Jim, I don't know if you can help provide some more information about that case study.
Sure. So I think one of our participants was asking about how those hydraulic conductivity measurements were acquired on such a fine scale. Again, this is the entire purpose of high resolution, is to acquire this information on a very fine scale. And what Ben mentioned about the methods, the traditional methods, are fairly large scale methods, aquifer level or screened interval level. But what we're talking about in terms of the heterogeneity and understanding heterogeneity, a very specialized tool needs to be used to get down to that resolution where you can draw those types of cross sections with very detailed groupings of hydraulic conductivity. So in this particular case, and we'll talk about these tools in module 4 in the live presentation, the particular tool that was used was the Waterloo APS Profiler. It's similar to the MIHPT tool, where it actually does a mini hydraulic conductivity test at a stationary point in the soil column. And that, coupled with some other hydraulic gradient information, can get you a hydraulic conductivity value. So that's how the Pease Air Force Base Site 32 data was collected on such a fine scale. Again, it was a high resolution.
A matter of inches, right, Jim?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, a matter of inches.
Very small range of testing interval.
Right. But going back to the Sudeikis example, that cross where, it was assumed to be a beach sand, but when they did that fine high resolution study, and they saw that, beach sand isn't beach sand, is actually quite a bit of variability in what they call the beach sand. Now, that was kind of before Waterloo and MIHPT and such were done. And those were actually done as individual cores, soil cores that were pulled out of a large diameter core and sent to the lab for traditional kind of hydraulic conductivity core testing.
Okay. And along those lines, one of the attendees said, in practice, it seems like the sites where the term HRSC is being used are sites where MIP is used. So in my head, HRSC is basically turning the sites into Swiss cheese with MIP. And they just want to know, is that a fair characterization, or are they off in what they're thinking in their head?
We have heard the word Swiss cheese before. But we're all shocked at such a cavalier approach. Direct push is the quickest, easiest, most common way to get high resolution data. There are any number of sensors that you can put on your tools, and those will be covered on Thursday, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, but that's only good for you know, as long as your soils are soft enough that you can actually push down through them. That's a problem, because sometimes your contamination is in a much deeper zone in the bedrock. And so your MIPS, you know, if you're working at Cape Canaveral, sure, you know, that's a piece of cake in the Barrier Islands there. But say in Michigan or in upper part of Minnesota, nope, that's not going to work for more than the first, you know, 8 or 12 feet.
Okay. So we also have a couple of attendees who are asking about some of the limitations or some of the drawbacks that might be present when we're using HRSCs, or some limitations. And they're just wondering if we're going to talk about that. And specifically, there was an observation that one of the attendees made, just noting that sometimes you can wind up going down these rabbit holes trying to interpret the sophisticated data sets from HPT or hydraulic profiling tools. And I don't know if anyone can comment on the observation of some of these limitations or challenges. Or if we'll talk about them in a later session, perhaps.
As we go through the individual tools and in module 4, and then kind of how to do an HRSC, kind of a detailed walkthrough of an HRSC in modules 5 and 6. We do talk about some of the limitations, but in general, the limitations are, yes, these are sophisticated tools. It's, you know, they're advanced, they have high technology. There are times when they work, as Ben mentioned, and there are times when they're not as effective. They do get damaged, some of them. MIP, LIF, they're delicate tools. They can't go through really dense materials. They can't go very deep. So some of the limitations are things like any time you'd have a limitation for a traditional drilling program, bedrock is a little bit of a challenge. Dense materials, if it's very deep, but geoprobes can't get very deep. And most of the tools we're going to talk about go on CPT or DPT type rigs. So that's a challenge. The availability of contractors, subcontractors who can effectively do this work. We've heard from a number of consultants, and I've had the personal experience working in certain parts of the country where it's difficult to find a cost-effective contractor who's knowledgeable enough to run a wide variety of tools. Some of these tools are quite specialized, and they have to come from a long distance. And you know, obviously, there's a high mobilization cost and just the availability of tools. So those are a couple of things, you know, depth, difficult drilling, availability of knowledgeable contractors. Ben.
Okay.
Yeah, and we shouldn't forget, but there's still that data management aspect of it all. You know, you need to be organized so that the data you collect is intelligible when you get back to the office, that it's in some sort of order that you can then apply your analysis to it. But the thought that sort of came to my mind is kind of like exercise. You start with, in your career, you start with simpler problems. And the more experience you have, you can pull in more information. And you can think in terms of a more complicated conceptual site model. And you can apply more of this information. But you're not going to start, you know, your job at EPA, you know, with a PhD level of complexity. Hopefully you get to cut your teeth on some simpler things that don't require nearly as much information to make your decisions.
Okay. I know we are getting very close to our scheduled end time of 3:30, and I want to respect the attendees' time limits here, but there are a lot of other questions in the queue. And again, the ones that I'm starting to see here, we're getting some technology recommendations and then some very site-specific requests. So if we have tools that would work in certain field conditions. So I'll be collecting all of these questions. They are not going anywhere. And remember, this is not the end. We are going to gather back together on Thursday of this week for part 2, where the training will carry on with the remainders of the material. Before I walk through final reminders, I just wanted to offer it up to the instructors. Any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with before I do those closeout instructions? And silence is
okay. I have one comment. So today and Thursday is not all of the material. This is a prequel to an in-person training. So if you didn't catch that when you were signing up, we probably won't have time to get through all of the info that you want to know about in these two webinar sessions. So I would encourage you to check on TrainX and see if there is an in-person training coming to your region or your area. And if there's not, ask your regional training coordinator to set one up. And, you know, for folks that are state employees, we can also set those up with you. You would just need to contact the EPA person to set up a course in the region.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much, Cindy. I think with that, I'm going to go ahead and walk through some final reminders here, and then we'll go ahead and close out today's session. So I want to thank all of our instructors for their time and expertise today. I'll rearrange a few things on the screen and call up those final reminders, and then we'll go ahead and close out today's live broadcast. So the first thing I'll do is I want to thank everybody for joining us and just remind everybody that we encourage you to visit the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org. You can connect with us on that site. Subscribe to our monthly newsletters like Tech Direct, where we'll highlight free training like today's session. If you haven't signed up, head on over to CLUIN. Look for the connect buttons. I do send out Tech Direct on the first of each month, so I hope that you'll add your name to that list and you can be alerted when we have future sessions available. The other thing that I wanted to remind everybody is that the presentation materials in the form of student manuals, they're PDF files that have already been posted on the seminar homepage. So this is the URL, you can screenshot it. If you look right underneath the title of the course, there are tabs and you can click on links for the webinar slides and related links. And that's where you'll find the course materials and resources. So if you're having any difficulties accessing those materials, feel free to send me an email. I'd be happy to work with you to get you those files. And as noted, there's contact information for our presenters and organizers there. You can also send an email to me at ballant.jean@epa.gov. If you have any follow-on questions, I'll be happy to get the question off to the right instructor. One thing that you can do is fill out the feedback form. There's a link to that on the seminar homepage. Oftentimes people ask for participation certificates. They ask for CEUs or PDHs. And while I'm unable to issue those types of credit hours, I can give you a participation certificate if you fill out the feedback form for today's session. So if you visit that seminar homepage, click on the link for the feedback form. You'll fill out a brief form. And at the very bottom, there'll be a box that you can check to certify you were here for the entire live session. If you check that box and then submit your feedback, you'll immediately have access to a certificate like this. You can either save it from the submission screen, also email a copy, but I always encourage people to save it just to be on the safe side. If you don't check that box certifying you were here for the whole thing, there will not be a certificate generated for you. If you happen to have multiple parties joining at your location, you can share the link to the feedback form with everyone who sat in with you, and they can fill it out to get their own certificate, even though they didn't register individually. And I will just remind everybody that our session was recorded today. You'll get an email from me as soon as that archive is available to replay on demand. I'm going to try to get it up before part two on Thursday, but no promises. But once it is up, you are certainly welcome to share that with any individuals that you think will find this to be a helpful session to replay. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying today's recorded webinar, you can still fill out that feedback form to share your thoughts with us, as well as to get a participation certificate. So just look above my head. There should be a feedback form button in the online archive version right now, and you can go ahead and click that button to access the form, fill it out, and get your own certificate. So with that, I will give another thank you to our instructors, our support staff on in the background, and the over 180 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and you'll be joining us for part two, where we carry on with this webinar on Thursday afternoon Eastern Time. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thanks so very much for joining us.